Welcome to the first episode of Climate Frontiers, a podcast series exploring the latest thinking, approaches, and debates in climate science, hosted by the Climate System Analysis Group, or CSAG, at the University of Cape Town. I'm Jessica Lee, your guest podcast host, a research associate at the Climate System Analysis Group at the University of Cape Town. This podcast episode is the last discussion in a series of conversations held over the past 6 months about the intersection of climate services and ethics. This was a collaborative project called the Knowledge Field Development of Climate Services Ethics and was funded by the National Research Foundation. The aim of the project is to bring together climate service practitioners from across South Africa to explore ethical issues related to their field. Ethics as a research topic is relatively new to the field of climate science and climate services. While some other professions have a code of ethics, like for instance doctors, lawyers, and engineers, there are no real checks and balances in place for climate service providers to reflect on some of the ethical aspects of their work. In this project, we held a series of workshops and smaller dialogue sessions where together we honed in on various aspects of climate services. We identified important ethical questions related to topics such as delivery of transparent and honest information, who has what responsibilities, structural issues related to data availability and commercial interests, and very importantly, the impact that collaboration of players across climate services can have. Today we have a conversation about the nature of climate services in South Africa, some of the challenges the practice faces, and together we explore some of the steps that are being taken and could be taken to maximize the benefit that climate services can have for society. In this episode, I spoke to three guests who work in the field of climate services and who have been working closely with me on this ethics project. Tracy Laban is a senior manager of climate services from the South African Weather Services.
I think what drives me is to live a life of meaning and purpose. I know it sounds like a cliche, but I have a background in atmospheric science. And, you know, I really want to use it in a science for service kind of way. So the big pull for me in applying for the climate services role was the opportunity to work in an area that's of real value to South Africa. It's got national benefit.
Chloe Romaru is the Chief Director of Climate Change Adaptation from the Department of Environment, Forestry and Fisheries.
I am responsible for adaptation planning across the country and the coordination of the National Framework on Climate Services. My passion has always been environment, growing up in the villages where I would be taken to the field. So I started learning a lot around botany, environment, understanding landscape, and that landed me into the studies of environmental science.
Chris Jack is the Deputy Director and a climate scientist at the Climate System Analysis Group.
I started studying environmental science and then switched to computer science and then ended up in climate science. But I guess my passion all the way along has been the environment and, if you want to say, trying to save the Earth. Even as a child, I always wanted to save the planet from terrible things. So in some ways, I've always been trying to do that in various ways, and the place I find myself at the moment is in climate science and trying to help society deal with climate change in some way.
I'll be chairing the discussion. My background is in philosophy of science, with a particular focus on philosophical issues related to climate science for decision making. I'm involved in a number of research projects running here at CSAG, and one in particular is the topic of today's discussion on the ethics of climate services. Thank you for joining this conversation. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, so before we start today, for the listeners who aren't familiar with climate services, I wondered, Chris, if you could maybe give us a brief definition of what climate services is.
Sure. Thanks, Jess. I'll start off by saying that there's a wide variety of definitions of climate services, so I think we need to keep it quite simple. Climate services is essentially any activity where climate science is being used to assist or inform real-world decisions. So we do a lot of climate science where we write publications or we write papers in academic journals, and that's how most of climate science happens, but that's not very accessible or very usable for the real world. So climate services is are attempts to take that climate science and make it usable for real-world decision-making. So I think a good example would be seasonal forecasting is a very classic example of climate services. So that's where, as climate scientists, we try and talk about or explain or predict in some ways what the next season's rainfall might be. So those of you who remember the big droughts in Cape Town and other droughts around South Africa, knowing what's going to happen in the next season is really critical. So a climate service would be trying to provide that kind of information. Climate services also extends to 30, 40, 50 years into the future, which is a very different kind of challenge. So a lot of climate services is focused on climate change information.
Great. And I think maybe I can extend a little bit on that. So I recently heard about a great project called the Climate Information for Resilient Tea Production, which was part of the Future Climate for Africa program in East Africa. Tea production is an important part of the local economy in Malawi and Tanzania, but tea plantations are already being impacted by climate change and will be more so in the future. The project brings together the latest climate science with strong stakeholder consultation to produce information that has the potential to help tea growers make the decisions that they need to make to avoid these impacts of climate change. I think that this is a fantastic example of the great value that climate services has in its potential to contribute to society. Of course, there are many such examples and examples within South Africa. And so I'm really interested in what your thoughts are on the strengths and value that these types of activities have in South Africa in terms of being a service to society. Chloe, if we could start with you.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you, Jessica. From South African perspective, climate services is crucial to help us in doing a long-term adaptation planning. As Chris has already alluded to, the observation network, the projections are central to the design of our adaptation planning strategies, adaptation planning policies, but most importantly, they are central to us building programs that will help the society at large to be able to adapt to the future climate.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jess. This is a great example. And I think especially because it illustrates the different aspects of the climate services value chain coming together to benefit society. It really drives home the point that the full value chain must be looked into. Because if one piece of the chain is missing, then our climate services system has a challenge. And I can give you an example of a climate service provided by the South African Weather Service where the full value chain was important. So as the National Meteorological Service, we provide weather-related early warning systems. But for a successful early warning system, you need a number of elements that make up the value chain. Firstly, you need a good observational network to tell you what the historical and current states are and as input to the forecasting process. Secondly, you need models to forecast, state-of-the-art numerical models. Thirdly, you need skilled forecasters to interpret observations and model output. Fourthly, you need relevant dissemination channels. And fifthly, you need the response by those receiving the information. And challenges in any of these areas will limit the value and effectiveness of the early warning system. We found this to be a case in point during two extreme weather events. We provided weather information for the tropical cyclone Idai that impacted Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi in March 2019, if you remember, and also for the floods over the KwaZulu-Natal province in April 2019. Our weather models gave indications of these systems in advance, and warnings were issued at least 2 days in advance in the case of Idai, and a day in advance for the KZN floods. Yet, despite the warnings going out in advance, as you know, there were still over 1,000 deaths in the case of Idai, and 70 deaths in KZN. So these two events show that the underutilization of the available science by individuals and organizations can cause extreme events to become deadly events due to a failure to act. And clearly, we realized that more needs to be done to increase weather awareness and improve disaster preparedness. So we're now working at increasing the number of community radio stations that receive weather information to reach a larger audience across South Africa. So I think these are some of the things we are working on to improve the effectiveness of our early warning systems and to strengthen our resilience to extreme weather events. And I think that's an example that shows how the full climate information value chain must be looked at.
Thanks, Tracy. Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you say that, how it's really important for the links in the value chain to be connected. Chris, I wonder if you could add to that.
Sure, thanks. And thanks, Tracy. I think I'm going to build on what you've been saying. I mean, for me, the South African context is very important and very unique in some ways. You know, we're, as a country, we're a developing nation. We're trying to implement infrastructure. We're trying to improve livelihoods for the citizens of the country, whether that's citizens living in cities or in rural areas. So there's a lot of challenges that the country is facing at the moment, as we're all very aware. But then we're also really aware of how climate and weather is impacting and adding to those challenges. So it's really frustrating to me when you see a good development project that is then impacted by a drought or impacted by an extreme event and infrastructure is damaged, valuable infrastructure that has been developed over time and has cost a lot of money that we don't have a lot of. So for me, the real essence of climate services in South Africa is the contribution it can make towards the development of the country. And the other aspect of that then, of course, is the huge inequality within our country and the different kind of access to resources that different people have. So one of the things that really concerns me around climate services is who has access to that information and in what form does that access happen. So, you know, if somebody has a really good internet connection and has really good connections to other people who can help them understand and interpret the information, if someone has a university degree, they might be able to study and have the kind of qualifications that could help them engage with that information. But that's not equal across society. So, you know, if we think of rural farmers who are trying to develop their farming or their agriculture into a livelihood or even beyond into an economic endeavor, you know, how do those farmers access this kind of information? These are really big, challenging questions. So I think a lot of what we've been wrestling with in the ethics project is the sort of equity of access to climate information and to science generally to assist in the development of the country. So yeah, I think there's a lot of potential, and I think South Africa has done really well. I think the Weather Service and other institutions have really been pushing the edge, if you like, of climate services. I'm very aware that other countries around the world actually have looked to South Africa in some cases for examples of how to do it well. Across Africa, you know, we're kind of leading the way in many of our climate services activities, but there's so much more that we can do to the benefit of the development of this country and to the benefit of, in some small way, addressing some of the inequalities across the country.
Yes, so concerns about equitable access are already speaking to this question, but I wonder if each of you could share some of the concerns you have about the climate services landscape here in South Africa and what kind of impacts you think they might have and what factors you think are contributing to these challenges.
Thank you, Jessica, and thanks, Chris and Tracy. I think some of the concern, the primary one, is, of course, the dissemination of information to all stakeholders across board, even those who don't have access to internet. I think it's one of the critical areas that if we are really to help our people on the ground with information that will help them to stay safe and to be secure and to protect their livelihood, we need to have mechanism to reach, you know, to those people who are a bit disadvantaged. And the other concern that we are having from my perspective is the concern of, the dissemination of conflicting messages, which will be coming from different key climate information producers. And this will, of course, confuse people on the ground in terms of how do they go about how to act and how would they make sure that they react to the impending challenge or warning that might be coming from different stakeholders. The third one, in my view, will be the issue of collaboration, where you find we've spoken about the infrastructure and the value chain, and we can also add the issue of resources that goes into the entire value chain. So if organizations work in silos, we obviously going to be spending a lot of money as a country collectively in terms of, you know, developing and producing climate information. So we need to make sure that we are able to collaborate across the different producers and ensure that we work together to ensure that we are able to produce climate information. The last concern for me is around feedback from the users on whether the climate information producers are just producing without having a proper interface and feedback from the users in terms of, one, the utility of the information, to the type of information that they are looking at, that they can apply in their own local context. So those, I would say, those are some of the overarching concern from my side. And I will come back later in terms of how I think they can be addressed, because I believe there are different mechanisms that can be played, put in place to ensure that these concerns are addressed. Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks, Chloe. And I look forward to hearing a little bit more about the National Framework for Climate Services when we chat about it a little bit later. Tracy, you spoke a little bit already about some of the challenges and concerns that you think climate services face, but I wonder if you want to expand a little bit on what Chloe said.
Yeah, thanks, Chloe, for those opinions, which I echo. I echo the sentiments that you have expressed. From my side, I think I can add a few more concerns from a national meteorological service perspective. I mean, one challenge for us is our deteriorating weather and climate observational infrastructure in the country. You know, some of the existing infrastructure we have is not well maintained. We also have manual stations as part of the network, which rely on volunteer observations, and those volunteer observers are declining fast. It's also hard for us to keep the long-term climate monitoring stations operating, because of issues of vandalism, land use, etc. So our current observational network just meets the WMO density guidelines, but it is on the brink of dipping below the required level for effective climate monitoring. And this is an area where we need to be doing much more financial investment in to support the rollout of climate services. Because if you don't have stable observational networks, you don't have data, then you can't create the climate services and products required. So the second concern, which is actually linked to the first concern of infrastructure sustainability, is the issue of data sharing policies and the call for free and open access to data. You know, we can't run away from this issue. It is a difficult issue to agree on or understand, because the playing field, I believe, is not level. Data is expensive to collect, to quality control, store, and disseminate. And there are some institutions that are fully funded by government and able to provide the weather or climate data free of charge, and others are not. And, you know, that's the reality for some state-owned entities, including the Weather Service, that the annual government grant is shrinking and we're being pushed to generate our own revenue to fund our operations as part of cost recovery. As a result, our current business model is that we provide data according to some charging model, but with the exception of students who get the data for free. And this enables us to do a number of things at the Weather Service, you know, invest in the quality of the data provided, maintain the infrastructure, and develop new products that will benefit the country. But having said that, we recognize, and you know, this has been the feedback we have been receiving from various stakeholders, that our current data policy will be obstructive to the objectives of the NFCS. And the challenge is how to get there. You know, how to change our business model and fund climate data going forward. And I think what we need in South Africa is data impact and value studies like cost-benefit analysis, for example, to gain a deeper understanding of the link between open data and socio-economic value for the benefit of the country. Then we can go to National Treasury with a business case for unleashing the full value of the data to the country. So those are my two key concerns from a weather service perspective. The other concern I have, and Chloe has mentioned that, and it's about the climate services provider community being quite fragmented in South Africa. And I think that's where he also emphasized the need for collaboration so that you don't get duplicated and competing climate services. And I think that's an important area where we need to bridge the gap between climate services providers and users of climate services.
Thank you, Tracy. Chris, I'm wondering if you could add a little bit about the ethical issues related to the production of climate science for climate services, your understanding coming from a climate modeler and a climate scientist yourself.
Sure. Thanks, Jess. And thanks, Tracy. I'd actually like to start by picking up on a point or adding to a point that Tracy's just made. And it's really around the question of incentives. And this does speak into the climate science later. I'll get to that. But we have to acknowledge that we're operating in a landscape that has different incentives, and there are different incentive models for why people are doing things in different ways. So Tracy's alluded to the economic challenge of keeping a weather station network alive and the need to charge for data in order to do that. You know, these are complex things that we need to negotiate. Other climate services providers, for example, our group at the University of Cape Town, we engage in climate services. But we need to be funded to do that. We're not funded through the government to do that in most cases. So we have to either charge for the service, or there has to be some kind of funding to make that happen. And inevitably, this sets up incentives to promote your product, to promote your solution or your service as somehow better or superior to the competitor. So even though we all get on really well within the South African community, there's always going to be tensions here and there, but generally we get on really well, we all have good intentions. There's this incentive structure that creates competition and kind of pushes us to promote our own products and our own services over those of others. And this extends beyond the South African context. So increasingly climate services are being provided, as I think Tracy mentioned earlier on. We can get weather forecasts from international platforms now. That's kind of routine. I think for most of you listening, you might use something like WindGuru or YR.no. You know, these are all international platforms providing these kind of services. And increasingly, the same is happening for other climate services. So there's a lot of online platforms and portals you can go to get projections for South Africa that come from international institutions. So there's this incentive structure that is causing a competition between climate services providers. And the incentive is to promote your product and your service as being superior. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think competition can often be a good thing in these landscapes, but it needs to be managed well. And that really is where this question of ethics comes out. So coming into the question of the climate science, my big passion at the moment is the transparency around assumptions that are made in the climate science in producing climate services. So as a climate scientist, as somebody who's developed climate service products and who has run models and tweaked models and done all of these things that happen behind the scenes, if you like, I'm very aware that in doing that, I make many, many assumptions. We often think of science as very objective, and that scientists make objective decisions based on hard evidence. And to some extent, that is true, but there are also many assumptions that we have to make. So, for example, if I'm talking about the next season's rainfall over the summer rainfall region of South Africa, as a climate scientist, I'll look at the numbers and I'll look at the statistics and the distributions and I'll decide what would be a dry season. And we might label a season as a dry season and another season as a wet season and another season as a normal season. And we have our ways of doing that, and it's based on certain assumptions based on statistics. But for a farmer, farming in the Orange Free State or wherever, you know, that definition of a dry season could be completely different. Our threshold for dry could be fine for a particular farmer, or it could be terrible for a particular farmer. But we make these assumptions as climate scientists, and there are many, many more assumptions we make. One of the key assumptions we make is how good our product is. So for weather forecasting, it's very quickly apparent if your weather forecast is bad. And for many of you using different weather forecasts, you'll know, you'll go to, you know, the South African Weather Service forecast because you've got confidence in it because it's routinely good. But you may have decided not to use a different one because it always seems to be wrong. So we can quickly evaluate them. But for climate change projections, where we're talking about what might happen in 30 or 40 years' time, how do we possibly evaluate that? So my concern is that as climate scientists and producers of these climate services, particularly for climate change timescales, we're overconfident about the skill or the value of our climate services. And at the same time, we're in this competition with other service providers to say that our product is somehow better, and we're making big assumptions there. And so for me, the big challenge there is, what is the consequence of that for people who end up using that, for end up designing infrastructure or making large financial decisions or shifting their crop species or crop variety to a different crop because of information that we provided? All these things have huge financial and other consequences. And if we're not confident and if we're not being transparent about these assumptions we're making, we could have very negative impacts on society as much as we're trying to have very positive impacts on society. So that's my sort of very large scale concerns about the landscape.
Thanks, Chris. Yeah, I think this idea around scientists needing to make assumptions is obviously part of a core thing that happens in science. And I understand that you say it's a very big challenge for users on the ground to make sense of these assumptions in some way. So I'm wondering if you could maybe tell us a little bit about what concrete steps you think could be taken to overcome these kinds of challenges. I heard you mention transparency, but what would that look like?
Yeah, so I mean, I can give you an example of work we've done, actually not in South Africa, work we did in Zambia. Working with decision makers in Lusaka. And there we tried a process where we tried to, in a very engaged process, you know, literally in a room with decision makers, two climate scientists, myself and a colleague from the UK Met Office in the UK, tried a process where we went through as many of the kind of assumptions that we were making, and we made them transparent to those who could potentially use the information. And we allowed them to help us make assumptions. So a classic assumption in climate projections is, which models do we exclude? So that we have multiple models projecting the future. We call them ensembles. It's a way of covering for model error. But sometimes those models look very wrong. They don't seem to simulate the past very well, and their future projections look very odd. So sometimes as climate scientists, we might want to exclude those futures because we don't necessarily trust the model. But again, that's an assumption. And we might be excluding a future that the decision makers are particularly concerned about. So we tried this process of making it very transparent what the assumptions were that we were making. We got very positive responses and feedback. We were quite concerned that if we opened up those assumptions, that the response would be, you don't know what you're doing. Like, how can you not know what the right answer is here? But actually, I think people valued the honesty and the transparency more than the possibility that we might not know the exact answer. And it developed a real sense of trust. So I think for me, kind of transparency and building trust is really, really key to overcoming this. And then just lastly, this question of competition. I think we need transparency and trust to be built between climate service providers. We need to be in an ongoing dialogue with each other about what assumptions are we making, because we're not making these assumptions out of any kind of bad intentions. We're trying to do the best possible. And the more that we're talking to each other about what have you done about this decision? How have you characterized a dry season versus a wet season? Can we get together and talk about this? What is your experience? What have you learned engaging with different decision makers? The more we can bring these discussions together and interrogate the assumptions and learn together, I think the more robust services we'll provide to society.
Thanks, Chris. It's really interesting to hear you speak about that project where you were on the ground with stakeholders, working with them to examine the assumptions and the work that you were doing, and really highlights the importance of transparency and trust is in some way gained through actual interaction with the stakeholders and users of the information so that you can develop the information together. Chloe, I want to come back a little bit to some of the challenges and concerns that you were talking about around collaboration and dissemination of conflicting messages. And I just wondered if maybe you could talk about some of the concrete steps that we could take in South Africa towards improving collaboration across the different actors in climate services.
Now, thank you, Jessica. Just to also chip in on what Chris was saying around the issue of transparency and the impact thereof, I think for policy making processes, it's even more important to have, you know, the information that is credible, the information that I would say it is, it has scientific rigor. Because that has a dire implication if we are going to do a policy and only to find that there are some limitations from the information provided and the type of programs that in a long run government will have to implement will also be impacted. And I think I just wanted to add further on what Chris was saying. But coming to the issue around the various steps that we are taking as government, we have developed a framework on climate services. And this framework in the main is aiming at bringing all key stakeholders together, bringing the users of climate information, bringing the information producers, bringing the intermediaries together to can work together and collaborate to enhance climate information and addressing some of the important elements that I think Tracy has already, you know, alluded to around the issue of data sharing, because we believe it's through partnership, through collaboration, that we can really enhance climate information production, dissemination, and ultimately climate change adaptation in the country. The framework have 5 key pillars. There's a pillar on user interface platform, and this is the platform where I think the issues around dissemination, the issues around ethical issues in terms of the climate information that will have been provided can be discussed, and there will be a proper feedback from the users. Users can also be guided on how to utilize the climate information products that will be coming from the producers, and the producers will also receive proper feedback in terms of the utility as well as the type of climate information or climate services products that the users are looking at. The second observation is largely on observation and monitoring. And I think Tracy has touched on this in terms of our monitoring capacity, our observation capacity, where it has to be sustainable, it has to be improved so that we are able to ensure that the climate information is provided even for the near future. We have climate services information system, and this is a system that will also be utilized for dissemination, system that will serve also as a repository of all these various products for ease of accessibility. We have research, modeling, and predictions that I think Chris and Tracy has also touched on. But the most important element is capacity development. The capacity of both the users, capacity of the state, capacity of the various role players to can also be able to assist in ensuring that we have a climate services products that are user-friendly to the society at large. I think in a nutshell, Jesse, that is the framework that we have put together, and we're currently moving on various pillars. One of the critical pillars that we will be moving is to launch a platform of engagement with all the stakeholders to ensure that we are able to, you know, create an avenue for engagement, an avenue for feedback, and an avenue for, you know, collaboration across the various key stakeholders. Thank you, Jessica.
Thanks, Chloe. It's really exciting to hear about the National Framework for Climate Services as a platform that really brings the different key stakeholders together. I'm really looking forward to seeing how it develops. Tracy, you also raised some really interesting challenges around the incentive structures and the problem with that. And Chris added to that, which I thought was really interesting, on how the sort of incentive structure pulls away in some sense or in the other direction from what is needed for collaboration. But the platform that Chloe has been talking about really sounds like an opportunity to overcome some of these challenges. Is there anything you'd like to add to what either of them have said today?
Yeah, thank you, Jess. I just want to also just touch on delivering honest and transparent information. You know, a classic example is the example of seasonal forecasts. There are various providers of seasonal forecasts, and for South Africa, there are huge uncertainties with these forecasts. And we know, we all realize that more reliable seasonal forecasts are needed. But the question is, who takes ownership for reliable forecasts? You know, if a person at a university makes a forecast and it's wrong, nobody is going to be too mad with them. But for a national entity like the Weather Service, which is a services provider primarily, who has the mandate to produce these operational forecasts, you know, we can get called to parliament if the forecasts do not go right. And so the obligation that we have to the user is massive. So I think that point needs to be recognized, that there are issues around accountability and responsibility and ownership for these different forecasts. And, you know, the responsibility is not the same. That is something that for me is an area we need to look at. How do we go forward with that? But coming back to your question about the National Framework for Climate Services and what Chloe has just mentioned about the different pillars. What I wanted to add was that there are multiple climate services providers in the country, such as universities, research councils, services organizations like the Weather Service. But the nice thing about this framework is that it's been able to actually link and develop the available elements to plug the gaps and fix the shortcomings. And I think that has been lacking, a framework for the delivery of climate services in a structured and coordinated manner. And this will avoid those fragmented, irrelevant, and competing climate services that I referred to.
Thanks, Tracy. I just want to come back for a second to a really interesting point that you made that I think is worth maybe exploring a little bit more and getting the opinion of our other two guests today, which was around responsibility and accountability. I really think that this speaks to the heart of climate services ethics, at least one of the main ethical concerns that we have in trying to navigate our understanding of what the responsibilities are of climate service providers and various stakeholders. I just wondered if the others wanted to add their ideas about trying to understand and navigate this idea of responsibility, because by its very nature, climate science, where it's at the moment, has a lot of uncertainty, which means that there is opportunity for the information to not be completely accurate or for it to be misunderstood in some way, and that's not necessarily a fault of anybody's. It's just the way that the science is produced and where the science is at the moment. But obviously there are people on the other side that are making decisions with this information, which creates such a challenge for the providers in terms of the confidence in providing that information. And I just wondered if anyone wanted to add anything to what Tracy was saying on that topic. Clau, why don't you start and then Chris?
I think, Jesse, you are mentioning a very important thing, and Tracy, on the roles and responsibility. And I think upfront, the responsibility of the producers is to produce information or products that are credible, that have science rigor, that can really be proven to have undergone the test of scientific test. But also I think it is also the responsibility of the producers to also understand their stakeholders in terms of the type of users that we have, because if we produce climate information or climate services products that the users are not able to use, it's going to be a bit of a challenge. We need to ensure that we produce it in a simplistic manner to ensure that the users are also able to apply it. And it is also the responsibility of the intermediary to make sure whatever they transmit in between, to make sure that they do not dilute the scientific rigor, you know, of the product. And the users should also be able to follow the guidance as provided, because at current, everyone will just use the information the way they see how. You know, they need to really follow the guidance as provided. Thanks, Jesse.
I mean, I think this is a really, really key question, obviously. And just picking up on something Tracy said, you know, several years ago, the CSAG at UCT, we used to issue our own seasonal forecast based on the models that we were running. And about 5 or 6 years ago, we actually stopped issuing that forecast exactly for this reason. We didn't feel like our product, we could really defend our product sufficiently. We knew that it had some weaknesses, and yet we were still making it available, and we decided that's actually unethical to do that. So, which was a really interesting start of this journey for us in some ways. But just around the responsibility thing, you know, I think in some ways there's a spectrum of responses, and you know, and internationally different countries are wrestling with this. We could go the whole the route of certification or having some kind of official. You need to be a qualified climate services practitioner in some way and meet some criteria to do that. Just like other professions, the medical profession, you know, you need to be a qualified doctor, you know, certified by some kind of method to make sure that you're qualified before you can practice medicine. And other disciplines are the same. You know, engineering, you need to be a qualified engineer before you can design a bridge or, you know, build a bridge. And, you know, we're wrestling with whether we should do the same for climate services. But I think the challenge there is the criteria for qualification is unclear. It's very difficult to come up with what would be a suitable qualification. And even within the world of qualified climate scientists, you know, if you take all the climate scientists that, whatever, have a PhD, there's still a lot of disagreement within that community about, you know, the correct way to go about producing climate services, which are the best models, which are the best approaches to communication, etc. So there's a lot of disagreement. So I think that route is extremely challenging. The other route is just to go free for all and say, well, anyone can do anything, and it's really the user's problem. So there are some climate scientists who would take that approach to say, I'm just doing my science and I'm making it open and available, which is what science is meant to do, and it's not my problem how it gets used. And I think the answer, as is often the case, is somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. It needs to be somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. And in order to be in the middle of that spectrum, it needs to be based on ongoing dialogue and discussion and real interrogation, again, of these assumptions that are being made. So I think that is the really key thing. And I think that's why that having this sort of platform is really exciting, a space where those ongoing discussions can happen and we can argue with each other. We can say, no, I think you're doing this wrong, and the person can defend it, and we can have these debates and deliberations and refine things and move the science forward. I think that's what's really exciting. But I think we need to take responsibility really seriously as we go forward.
Yeah, and I think somebody might argue that maybe you need legislation to do this, you know, to get people to take that obligation. But of course, we have too much legislation already, so I don't know if we need any more. But, you know, that is one route as well.
Mm. Yeah, it's so interesting because we shouldn't underestimate the complexity in understanding what responsibility would even look like in this field. It is a complex field. It's multidisciplinary. You have, you know, people from all different areas, academic disciplines, stakeholders. And so to try and determine who should be doing what is not, it's not that simple. I don't think climate services is really at the stage where you could just simply write up a code of ethics and say, this is how it should be done and everyone should abide by this. Rather, what you're suggesting, Chris, and what the NFCS is, I guess, trying to achieve is creating a space where we can have these discussions and start to really unpick and untangle the complex issues so that we know what would need to be done to move forward. And from that, determine whose responsibilities lie where. So,
if I can just add something, I think it's important to acknowledge that this is something that's been wrestled with internationally. So it's not like South Africa is trying to catch up. You know, I know, Jess, you've been involved in a workshop around this topic in the United Kingdom. And I've been at various international conferences in climate services where these discussions are happening. And in all the countries around the world are trying to figure out how to negotiate this space. So it's really exciting. And, you know, I think if we can really make this platform work well, we can be leaders internationally in how we implement climate services.
Great. So the final question that I'd like to ask my guests today is, how do you think a better, more coordinated, and more ethical climate services would impact our listeners and the public at large? Tracy, we can start with you.
Collaboration between climate services providers will definitely bring this community closer together and ensure that we don't see each other as a threat, but we fill in the gaps and the shortcomings, and we generate or produce products for different sectors. And we prevent duplication and competition so that no one is left behind. I think the collaboration on the level regarding climate scientists and climate services users is also necessary. It needs to also bring these two groups together because we want to ensure we don't produce irrelevant climate services. And so we co-design the products with the users and tailor it to their needs. You know, it doesn't help if researchers go ahead and develop nice things if it's not done in close cooperation with users. And so we need this feedback loop between what is required and what is produced. And at the end of the day, you know, there are limited resources and human capacity in the country. And for things to happen in South Africa, it's really important we work together and we pool our resources. Because I believe that collaborative efforts have the potential to exceed those of any single institution, you know, acting alone.
Thank you, Tracy. Chloe, maybe if you could speak a little bit about how you think more ethical climate services and more coordinated climate services would impact our listeners and the public.
Thank you, Jessica. I tend to agree with Tracy to say one primary thing for us is through the mechanism that will be established, the governance mechanism through the framework on climate services, because it is through collaboration between the climate change producers amongst themselves and collaboration between the climate change producers and the users, which in essence involve even the general public to can have access to climate information and ensure that the decisions that they are making are informed.
Thank you. Chris?
Thanks. I'm not sure that I have a huge amount to add. I think I would like to just come back to something I said earlier on in this discussion around the realities of South Africa, and that we are a country that is aiming to develop infrastructure and services and livelihoods and to lift people out of poverty. And I think, you know, for me, that I keep coming back to that kind of focus in the South African context. And I think, you know, climate services does have a real part to play in that picture, in helping figure out what the right decisions are, what the right shifts in policy are, what the right implementation of infrastructure is. So I think my dream, if you like, is that through this platform, through the engagement and the dialogue and the discussion, through advances in the science, through deep interaction with decision makers and stakeholders, that as South Africa develops and as we slowly but surely manage to progress this country forward, that our climate resilience would be enhanced, that we wouldn't have infrastructure that is destroyed by extreme events, you know, that we would have farming, agricultural development that raises livelihoods and lifts people out of poverty, that we would have urban settlement development that is resilient to drought, you know, and that climate risk and climate hazards would fail to hold back the development of the country. So that's kind of my dream, and I think having this kind of platform is really core to that dream, to bring the capacity together. I think South Africans are really effective when they come together to solve big challenges, and so for me this is a little big picture of that kind of collaboration in play. So I'm excited, and I'm very keen to be involved in it as it goes forward.
Tracy, Chloe, Chris, this has been a really interesting conversation, both today and the ongoing one through the project. I've really enjoyed working with each of you over the past few months and exploring the various challenges that climate services face here in South Africa and exploring the opportunities for growth. So I just want to say thank you very much.
Thank you, Jess. I really enjoyed the conversation, and we just need to keep the collaboration going forward.
Thank you, Jess. Thanks, Tracy. Thanks, Chloe.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Climate Frontiers. Look out for future episodes on this platform, or subscribe to the CSAG newsletter at csag.uct.ac.za to be alerted to our new podcasts. This project was brought to you by CSAG at the University of Cape Town and funded by the National Research Foundation. This episode was produced by Andre Burnett and Jessica Lee. Original intro song created by Leroy Nell. This is the CSAG community, connecting science and society for positive change.